Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, celebrating 30 years as local hearing healthcare professionals. With a practice featuring 5 doctors of audiology, including 2 who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Bloomington Normal Hospital employees don't have to quarantine after a close contact unless they show coronavirus symptoms. OSF St. Joseph Medical Center President Lynn Fulton tells Eric Stock OSF is following guidance the CDC implemented as hospitals across the country struggle to maintain adequate staffing.
The demands for staffing obviously have increased. And, you know, healthcare workers, they're not immune to the virus, unfortunately. You know, we don't have the vaccine out yet, and they catch it when they're out as well. So we do have staff that become ill and have to be off. So, and we've seen that really across all of our operating units. But today I will share, you know, OSF St. Joseph specifically, because I tend to know a little bit more about what's going on under our roof. You know, our staffing, you know, I would probably rate it as solid today. You know, we do have some of our employees who are off for illness, but we don't have high numbers off. You know, we have just sporadic call-ins that honestly we have this time of year every year, even absent a pandemic. But we have not, again, you know, say a prayer and knock on wood, we have not seen a huge increase here locally in any of our areas.
And how much has the need for quarantining potential close contacts impacted staffing?
We follow, because we're healthcare workers, so we have different guidelines that we follow for quarantine from the CDC. Because if you think about it, healthcare workers, we come in contact with communicable diseases all the time. And so if we quarantine for everything that we came in contact with, we wouldn't have anybody to work. And so what we've practiced here and that hospitals have across the country is what we call universal source control. So the masks that our frontline clinicians wear are hospital-grade PPE. So they're wearing those regardless of whether they have had any exposure or not, so that they're protecting their patients from them, so that if they do have anything, they would protect the patient who is in front of them. So all of our healthcare workers on the front lines are wearing hospital-grade masks as well as eye protection 24/7 while they're here. So our need for quarantining is not the same as, you know, for example, you know, when my kids were in the school system before they went back to virtual, you know, if they were exposed, they were asked to quarantine for 14 days because they're following those school guidelines. We follow the CDC guidelines for healthcare workers.
So you mentioned that staffing as of today is solid. How has that changed, or how much of a challenge has that been to keep everyone, to keep the facilities fully staffed?
Well, you know, I mean, it's obviously staffing during a pandemic. You know, I'm not going to tell you that it's easy. One of the nice pieces about being part of a ministry is that we do have plans in place to address staff shortages. You know, we first utilize those that are already scheduled to work, implementing overtime and floating staff to different areas of the hospital if they have competencies in those areas. So, you know, in a pandemic, sometimes you have one area that's really busy, you know, like our intensive care unit has been really busy really since March. So then we would float staff from other areas to assist those nurses in that area. And then if that staffing isn't adequate, then we also have our ministry. We have I don't know if I'd really call them a float pool, but they're called clinical resource. Our nurses that are available through our ministry that can work at a number of our sites, and they will be assigned, you know, based on the need within OSF. And so we're able to lean on that as another source of staffing.
Have you had healthcare workers leave?
You know, our turnover rate right now, while we've had You know, we have staff leave. We employ, you know, in Bloomington Normal, OSF employs over 2,000 people. And so we do have some turnover. The last time I looked, our turnover rate actually has not increased since the pandemic.
Were you concerned about that coming in, since one might imagine turnover would be high in a high-stress, high-demanding job like that?
You know, I am, and I continue to be concerned, quite honestly. You know, it is high stress, and, you know, I don't want to minimize what everyone else is doing right now, because I think the pandemic and what's going on in the world is stressful for everyone. So when I'm speaking of healthcare workers, definitely not minimizing what everyone else is going through as well. But caring for individuals with this virus, and, you know, kind of seeing it day in and day out, and how it can really take a toll, and then hearing about it all the time out in the public, I think it's really hard for healthcare workers to turn it off, you know, to be able to get that time that's just for them so that they can decompress. And so my concern is, you know, the pandemic goes on longer and longer, is the toll that that's taking on the front line. You know, at OSF, we're putting in a number of strategies to try to help our employees with that, to try to help them build resilience and to be able to really feel that they can disconnect when they're home. But that's easier said than done. And so really trying to support them through this, because we have tremendously gifted team members here.
And as the holidays approach, of course, the common concern is that cases are rising, hospitalizations are rising, certainly in McLean County and across much of the state and much of the country. And I know the holidays are kind of a unique situation for healthcare workers in many cases anyway, because they're already working these days. They don't always get to see family like the rest of us, and there's the added stress there. So how do you help them cope during this time and prepare for what could be coming in the next few weeks?
You know, it's a great question. And, you know, one I've asked myself many times as well. You know, communication isn't everything. Always come down to communication. I'm really trying to talk and connect with our team. And also, one thing that I asked them recently is, you know, all of us have our circles of influence. There's no better time to use that than today, and encourage your circle of influence to stay home and to not have the large gatherings that we've become accustomed to for the holidays. You know, I gave an example of myself. I'm like, you know, I talked to my sister and said, hey, I don't think that we should get together for Thanksgiving. I really think mom and dad need to stay in their house in Macomb, Illinois, and we can FaceTime them and talk to them, because, you know, my parents are aging. My dad has some health conditions. And I look at him and say, if he would catch this and become critical, I'm not sure we'll have a bed for him. So where's he going to go? Who's going to take care of him? And people should be having those discussions in each of their households.
That's OSF St. Joseph Medical Center President Lynn Fulton with Eric Stock. Carl Broman could not provide an official for an interview, but Chief Nursing Officer Lori Round says the company has seen an increase in staff infected with COVID-19. Carl Broman's policy is similar to OSF. Staff does not have to quarantine unless they show COVID-19 symptoms. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Andrew Jackson Smith was born a slave in Kentucky in 1842, the probable son of a slaveholder. He escaped to the Union Army when in Kentucky, the 41st Illinois, and went on to distinguish himself in battle. Smith was awarded a Medal of Honor, but not during his lifetime. His descendants had to wait 130 years. Retired Illinois State University history professor Sharon McDonald has written a book about the life of Andy Jackson Smith and his legacy. It's called Carrying the Colors. McDonald says there's a central Illinois connection to Major John Warner, for whom John Warner Hospital in Clinton is named. Smith became Warner's servant and was shot twice in the head at the exceptionally bloody Battle of Shiloh when he was taking Warner's wounded horses away from the front. Smith then spent about a year in Clinton before returning to the war, which McDonald says was problematic.
It was illegal, and Warner kept on his status in the community to protect him, and it did. But there was a law against bringing slaves into, or any blacks really, into Illinois. This exclusion law, it was popular, it was strong, and the idea was just try to keep any black person possible out of the state, stop immigration. And there was severe penalties for coming into the state or for harboring any blacks in the state.
So it's a great relief when Andy Smith enlists, and he joined the 55th Massachusetts. He goes on and
conducts himself as a pretty good soldier, according to the book and according to all accounts. Mm-hmm. And at the Battle of Honey Hill in 1864, he's part of the Color Guard. The regiment was ordered to charge to draw fire so another unit could flank and attack a gun battery. It did not go well. They charged again, and that didn't go well. And Smith grabbed the colors when people on either side of him were shot with canister. How unusual was it, and how tough a thing is it to say, you know what, people on either side of me died, and I'm going forward?
You sort of had to put yourself in the position of someone who is running the length of a football field uphill into the face of six cannon being filled with canister. Now, canister, it's like little ball bearings. They're shot out, the container expands, and they just fly over and turns the field into a shotgun blast. You know, to do that, I don't know where people get the courage. The Color Guard is put in the very front rank and to lead the charge. The guns fire, but they're aimed to arc over the front and hit the middle of the column where he would have been if the colors hadn't been moved forward. And then it takes them about 30 seconds to reload. In that 30 seconds, they run up from the creek about 93 yards towards the base of the Confederate battery, and they get within 20 yards of that battery. And we have that testimony affirmed by the Confederates. The Confederates fire the next round. They are so close to the front of those cannon that the round of canister does not have time to expand before it hits the color sergeant in the chest. That's how close they were. Smith said he grabbed the falling color sergeant with one hand and the flag with the other. And he's not the only one up there. I mean, that took incredible courage. What a lot of people don't understand is what's so important about saving that flag. They only had communications by sight on the battlefield, and the regiment is supposed to follow the flag. It advances with the flag, it retreats, maneuvers one way or the other. It follows its flag. If that flag goes down, they've got no orders.
It sounds heroic, and yet he had to wait 130-plus years to be recognized for that heroism and that Medal of Honor.
At the time, I said it was the most delayed award of a Medal of Honor, of any medal in nation's history. That goes back to 1916, when Burt Wilder, the surgeon of the 55th, recommended him for the Medal of Honor. Civil War recommendations for Civil War Medals of Honor went on until 1918, when the law cut them off. So it was a legitimate nomination, met every existing requirement. The trouble was, that was in the era of Woodrow Wilson, who introduced segregation into the federal civil service. The atmosphere wasn't particularly right, but they just suppressed the existence of the evidence. The evidence was right there in the War Department records, right where Andy Bowman found it back in the mid-1990s.
Rectifying the historical oversight was very important to Andy Bowman, a descendant, and to Carruth, who was a descendant. What's the importance of Andy Jackson Smith's story for today, in the present moment, the story of his heroism?
Our history has pretty much suppressed the history of black Americans. And even they didn't know that their ancestors fought for their freedom. Andy Bowman didn't know that. He said that prior to learning that his grandfather had fought for his freedom, he says, "I was really just here, not having any association with the past. It wasn't until I recognized that I did have a past, that my family contributed to this country through the Civil War and afterwards. The fact is we shed blood and tears for this country, and it made me feel a whole lot prouder of myself. I now feel comfortable with myself. I am who I am. I am happy to be here. All in all, it made our whole family feel as if we are a part of the United States. We had a significant input into making this country into what it is today."
What about his life after the war? He stayed a time in Clinton and then returned to Eddyville, Kentucky, and the area of Grand Rivers, where he farmed and became a part of that community.
This is ties into its importance as a historical work. The modern manifestation of the black middle class that Andy Smith helped to build in Kentucky and that permeated the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and since. And this middle class has not received the attention it is due from historians, and people treat it as if it didn't exist. But there was a book University of Illinois brought out in 1990, Lauren Schlesinger, black property owners in the South. He charged that the growth of this southern black middle class, and it's rooted in the ownership of property, both landed property and personal property, or goods, goods you could sell in town, so it's both rural and urban. This is a very important part of the black history of this country, and it produced many solid citizens. It produced people who were well-educated. Knowing this history, you know, can explode myths. But what we have done is to produce the only biography of a soldier, an escaped slave, who became a part of this middle class. Every place else, they have snapshots of people's lives, but no one has yet produced a biography. And this is because of the dearth of written records surrounding a people who are emerging from slavery.
And Andy Smith himself was not literate.
He was not literate. He signed his name with an X. For us, that's the great contribution of this book, that we were able to recover the full life of an illiterate person from the era of slavery, and we proved it could be done. And so what we're hoping is that other people will look at what we did and imitate it, because there are others out there.
Sharon McDonald is a retired ISU history professor. She and Robert Beckman are the co-authors of Carrying the Colors, The Life and Legacy of Medal of Honor recipient Andrew Jackson Smith. It's just out from Westholm Publishing. This is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's Public Media. There might be a link between the evolution of stone tools and the evolution of language among early humans. Shelby Putt is a bioanthropologist at Illinois State University. She's looking at ancient tools probably created by a likely contender for a direct ancestor to modern humans, Homo erectus. In this interview with student reporter Cameron Kelly, Putt says Homo erectus was a very successful species that lasted from 1.8 million years ago to about 110,000 years ago.
We think the reason that is because they were the first hominin or human-like species that focused more on technology, and they had a larger brain size, they had longer legs. In general, they were just much more human-like than everything that came before them, and so they are exploiting this new human-like strategy of living on the earth.
And why did you choose to study the link between verbal communication and the manufacture of stone tools?
Well, I think we have to go back to my college days when I was trying to discover myself and figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I was thinking, you know, how do I combine my love for language? Because I've always been interested in, you know, how did we get language? It's a very unique adaptation that we see in humans that we don't see in any other animal species. Unfortunately, language doesn't fossilize, right? We can't just find a bone that tells us whether a human species had language or not. So we have no idea exactly when language evolved. The next best thing is going to be the archaeological record. And we have stone tools that go back to at least 3.3 million years ago. We might be able to use those stone tools to try to figure out when language evolved.
Are there any conclusions that you have reached?
We're never going to know for sure. We can put some really educated guesses out there. So the work I've done has been to attempt to look at the brain activity while making stone tools, because we do know what parts of the brain are involved in language. And if we can see those same brain areas lighting up while making stone tools as well, then that might give us some clues. The work that I've done was looking at some of the earliest stone tool technologies called the Oldowan and the Acheulean. So the Oldowan goes back to 2.6 million years ago. The Acheulean goes back to about 1.8 million years ago. And my research so far has been looking at, you know, the differences in brain activity of people recreating these different technologies. And so far, it does seem to look promising that the shift from the Oldowan to the Acheulean technology may have sparked some type of language evolution. So I mentioned that the old one is dated back to 2.6 million years ago. They're very simple tools. Most people would pick them up and not even realize they are tools because they're just kind of round pebbles that have maybe one sharp edge on them because somebody used a hammer stone and knocked off a flake or two. But once you get to the Acheulean industry, that's when you get these more standard shaped tools. Think of like an arrowhead and just like make that gigantic. So something that's going to like fit in the palm of your hand, but has that teardrop shaped look to it.
How do you come up with new ideas to research?
How I started on my research path was reading this article in a seminar I was taking by a man named Dietrich Stout. He had started doing similar work with stone tools and language and neuroimaging. And with science, it's very rare that you just come up with a completely novel idea that no one's ever thought of before. Pretty much every good idea has already been thought of before, okay? But what you do is you read it and you say, okay, this is great, but it seems like they missed out on some aspect, right? And you can then hone in on what they missed out on or what they could have done better. And what I honed in on was he was really emphasizing language evolution from his results, but he hadn't actually controlled for language instruction among his participants. So you have all of these people who are learning to make stone tools with language. And then he's saying, oh, well, look, the language areas of the brain are lighting up. I'm like, well, of course they are. They learned with language. So they're probably recalling all of these sentences and instructions that were provided them while they were making the stone tools. So my experiment then went on to test that aspect of it. Like if we take away language instruction, do we still see the same language areas of the brain lighting up? And we don't. So that's why I said it's a bit inconclusive. We have to be careful with these results. It's very possible that stone tools and language are closely related evolutionarily in the brain, but there may be some things we have to tease out first.
That's bioanthropologist Shelby Putt of Illinois State University talking with student reporter Cameron Kelly. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.